Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't know.
Welcome to Faith of Appalachia, Hidden Stories of Faith and Value, where we explore personal narratives, particularly around Central Appalachia, where so many people think of us as a monocultural experience, where everyone's the same. My experience has been that's not actually true. That people are very rich in their diversity, but oftentimes, sometimes people have to keep it close to the vest because we have this larger narrative of monoculturalism. So I'm Rob. I'm a chaplain and a priest. And I'm excited for you to meet some of the people that I know and I really admire, and some people are brand new to me. But either way, join me as we dive in. I'm especially grateful for our grant sponsor, Kentucky Humanities, National Endowment for Humanities. Today, we have a special guest. Daxon's with us today, and we've known each other for a little bit, and I have really appreciated your really humble approach to just like meeting people where they're at. Just really have admired that with you.
Well, thank you.
So would you kind of introduce yourself for us?
Yeah, my name's Daxon Caudill. You know, people familiar with the area will know I grew up, in this area. My name is from this area. You know, it's funny now that I moved back here, I never have to spell my last name. You know, like in Lexington, I had to do that a lot. I was raised in a little town called Clay City, back in the, end of the sort of the industrial era. It was, I think, the world's largest sawmill outside of Japan.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it had a two log draw and, just basically sawing lumber day and night. You know, this was been in the 1880s, to the maybe late 1800s. I'm not real, 100% sure on the history, but at some point all that collapsed and, it just sort of, when I grew up there in the 70s and 80s, it was just a sort of sleepy Appalachian, kind of fringes of Appalachia. Now that I live in Appalachia, I realize I didn't know what it was until I moved here, but sort of between Central Kentucky and Appalachia, so it has that kind of crossover. I embraced Buddhism after quite a lot of soul searching. I lost my paternal grandmother and my maternal grandfather within about 3 months of each other.
Whoa.
To cancer, different forms of cancer. And I think that sort of set me on a soul searching that resulted in an abiding interest in Hinduism, which I still have.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of turned more and more toward Buddhism. And well, I'm not going to speculate about what it is that appeals about to me about Buddhism, but I've really sort of been interested in both, and I guess you would say I didn't really officially become a Buddhist until probably 1992, I think. I was out of high school, and I went away to Lexington, to University of Kentucky, and I became involved in this secular meditation path, which was called Shambhala training. It was invented by a man called Chögyam Trungpa. That's Chuki, which is ocean or big lake in Tibetan, that's Jamso. So Chuki is like a dharma. Okay. Chu is dharma. And then Jamso is big lake. Tso is lake. So Jamso is like vast lake or ocean, basically, since they don't have those in Tibet, went with that. But so he's like ocean of dharma is kind of his translation of his names. And he was believed to be a reincarnated master of that, the Trungpa line. And so, lamas went out and found him, much like they do the Dalai Lama or the Karmapa, and brought him in. And there were sort of these divinations and tests done. And they said, okay, this is the kid. And so he was raised up as the, I believe he was the 12th Trungpa. I could be wrong about that. My as I get older, all this stuff that I used to know right off. You know. But in any case, he was a pretty unconventional guy. He drank a lot. You know, a lot of people said he was an alcoholic, and I don't necessarily say that he wasn't, but he had a lot of lovers. You know, it was the 70s. I think there was a fair amount of cocaine involved and some LSD, and, you know, and a lot of people sort of viewed him as tainted because of that. But his view of it was, you know, if I sit here as a monk with my head shaved and in my robes, people aren't going to really be able to relate with me. And so he returned his vows, grew out his hair. But then the other odd thing that he did was that he bought a suit later on, and suit and tie, and he encouraged people like Gregory Corso and Allen Ginsberg.
Okay.
You know, they were just wild. Well, particularly Gregory Corso, I believe. He was the one I heard stories about in the Shrine Room. You know, he would sort of shout at Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, you tell him Shogun, you know, or Shogun, you know, and he would say a few more words, and it was like, you tell him, you know, and they would finally, he was like, out, you know, and the sort of guards came and kind of collected him, and I mean, I don't think they had, you know, really, they were trying to be an enlightened military, you know, and so okay. They came and kind of scooped him up, and then Trungpa Rinpoche apparently just erupted into laughter for about 3 minutes. He thought the whole thing was hilarious. But, you know, he was trying to teach, and he couldn't pretend to teach. So at some point, they had these kind of hippie communes, you know, and Trungpa Rinpoche made them burn all their weed
okay.
at one point in a very ritualistic way. He continued to drink, but he felt that drinking had a sort of built-in earth quality. You know, you can only drink so much before you get sick and vomit or pass out or, you know, and he felt like weed was all heaven and no earth.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And so, he was not, yeah, that was his thing, you know, however you want to view that. And, so they all burned their weed and, they did drink a lot. There was a lot of drinking problems, a lot of, you know, a lot of abuse problems that came out later with the Me Too movement and some of that. So it's a real mixed bag, like just about every religious institution, the Catholic Church, I mean, you name it, the Mormons, you know, we've all been through it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, I don't know if the Episcopal Church was shielded or not, but I doubt it, right?
Yeah, no, so, it's yeah. Where humans were, there
yeah,
was abuse.
Yeah, so it's there. So that's made it, I guess, complicated for me later in life. And as you know, I went and moved to, I sort of had a, I guess some people would call it a midlife crisis. But at some point I realized I didn't have a master's degree. And I was working in higher education. And in order to work in higher ed, even if you're, you know, chief bottle washer or whatever the old saying is, you know, you have to have a degree, a higher degree. And so I didn't have one. And so I thought, well, if I want to do serious academic study of Buddhism, and I study in Nepal at this particular place, Rongjung Yeshe Institute, I'll be taken seriously. If I never go into that and I just stay in higher ed as an administrator, they won't care anyway, but it'll be a master's. And so I cleaned out my retirement account for the most part, you know, enrolled myself. I was a study abroad advisor. So I enrolled myself as a study abroad student, got some student loans, you know, which of course I didn't end up taking nearly as much as I ended up having to take. But, and I studied there for just about 2 years, give or take, up to the point that we had the Gorkha earthquake. That struck 1 week before I came back to the United States. And so there was a week about roughly there after living abroad for quite some time in Nepal and really falling in love with Nepal. I got to sleep next to the people of Nepal in doorways and on tennis courts and, you know, out in, you know, patios and verandas, you know, because we were terrified to go back into the houses in some cases.
Wow.
So, you know, the Nepali people, I mean, we were all stuck there together and they shared what they had. They had tarps and things strung up for us. And so my roommate and I, you know, sometimes we sleep one night with this family and then we moved over to the, you know, the Hilton, I think it was, or the Hyatt, I can't remember which. Again, as I say, as I age, some of the stuff start, the details start slipping. But you may have had one of these dreams where you're like, with people from the college here where you work, and then like suddenly your like extended family is also yeah. and you're all at a party, but strangely the party is like in a rock quarry or like somewhere or like, you know, in a park that's somewhere not here or related to your family. Yeah. Like it's a park that you were once in Cleveland or something, you know, and you're like, why am I dreaming that? You wake up the next day, right? And you're like, so I lived that, right? Mm. Like I'm in with all my classmates and I'm, you know, in my mid to late, I guess I was in my mid 40s then. And I like, you know, wake up in the morning, I'm sleeping on a tennis court outside. I think it's the Hyatt there. And, you know, all my professors, my classmates were all like out on these tennis courts because, you know, it's open. There's nothing yeah. around us that can fall on us. And we're all just kind of chilling, you know. So it was a terrible experience, you know, in some sense, but yeah. also a trip in other ways. But
okay, that happened at the kind of the close of your 2-year experience.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I was about to leave.
So you think about kind of like a final exam and any kind of, you know, that here yeah. you are, you have this experience.
Yeah.
And what did that do for anything that you had learned or grew into during those 2 years? How did that experience kind of tie into that?
Well, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I would love to tell you some sort of story that it all crystallized yeah. and everything became. I mean, clearly impermanence, you know, that's the central theme mm-hmm. of Buddhism. And, you know, 1 minute you're a graduate student, quote unquote, and you're, you know, I was kind of doing the prep, or maybe I guess I was in the first year of the MA program, which I withdrew from, and it just basically kind of declared academic bankruptcy. I had been sick a lot up to that point, so sure. I really didn't get any credit for what I was doing because, you know, it was just with Nepal, you know, the allergies and everything, I was just falling apart. And I think one of my professors sort of thought I was just malingering and putting the whole thing on, or maybe, but really I think it was partially depression. And yeah. But I really truly was ill, you know, just constantly. It was like, you know, having a bad cold all the time. And, yeah. you know, you start out with dysentery every sort of week.
Oh,
you know,
gosh,
like,
terrible.
And then it goes to every 2 weeks and then every, you know, and then 3 weeks. And eventually you get to where you just tolerate it. But for me, that kind of started to wear off and my health started to decline. And being older, so it was just impermanence, you know, one day I'm this and the next day it's like, well, I don't think this is tenable at all. And I had already kind of made that decision. Like, this is just not tenable. I'm yeah. trying to do 25 years of work and, you know, and I don't have any frame of reference to really understand the philosophy I'm studying. Mm-hmm. I was really kind of caught, you know, in between a rock and a hard place. Then I came back and I had PTSD. Basically, yeah. you know, and I didn't know that I had PTSD. I mean, I knew my heart would race, you know, if I heard certain noises and things. But anyway, so I had a sort of a mental health crisis of sorts. Fortunately, it was not a very severe one, and I was able to handle it. And I think that's ultimately kind of what put me on my path to becoming a social worker and wanting to do therapy with people yeah. is kind of understanding the trauma and mm-hmm. coming to grips with that. And so, sorry, I don't know, I may be far off the question you asked.
No, that's incredible.
But that's sort of, you know, I mean, I don't know to what degree any experiences in our life ever really gel, okay. right? Or there are these moments,
yeah.
right? And that ties into kind of the Buddhist notion of samadhi or prajna is probably a better word in Sanskrit. In Zen tradition, my understanding is that pragya or prajna, the Sanskrit word, is pretty similar to satori. It may be a direct. Mm. So the idea, you know, the Zen idea of they whack you on the back and you have this experience of awakenment, you know, that there's no meta experience. At that point, it is an experience, right?
Yeah, okay.
And most of the rest of your life is some sort of a meta experience, right? A sort of, I think the French term is on abyss. You know, it's in an abyss, right? Those, like if you ever see a picture of a dog food can and it has a dog on it,
yep.
who's carrying a dog food can, and that dog food can yeah, has a, you know, that whole thing, right? That's how we perceive reality, really, on some level, is that our mind is you know, we have kind of the watcher within, you know, kind of the projectionist in the booth that's mm-hmm. always watching the film, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a level of removal from the direct experience. And when we have Satori, we have kind of this sense of oneness, I guess. Mm. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm going way out on a limb here, but I think that's probably what monastic people experienced in the Middle Ages, you know, is this transcendent experience of the divine or the, what would that be, sort of supernumeral, you know, or, I mean, basically transcendent, something mm-hmm. beyond the phenomenal, you know,
yeah.
I guess.
The sense of oneness, right? The sense
of, and then that extends to other human beings who are also having this, you know, it's sort of like you've heard the whole thing of, you know, we're all like divine beings wearing some sort of a flesh suit or, you know, like, you know, we're, you know, and of course the materialist view is that we're all computer positronic brains, you know, it's like a 1950s science fiction thing, right? Like we're all positronic brains walking around in flesh suits. And if we can just get in there and dial the tiny little set screws or, you know, resolder this wire that, you know, and, obviously it's, you know, and then you come into, there's situations where now we have credible, apparently, academic or, you know, scholarly evidence that actually we're not positronic brains or divine, you know, we're bacteria that are sloshing around in the gut that are driving this giant being around trying to get us more yeast or sugar or, yeah, I mean, you know, so it sort of operates on all levels. But anyway, I'm trying to, as I editorialize here, kind of sprinkle in these Buddhist ideas. But, you know, there's a Buddhist image that's often presented when people present Buddhism kind of the public, and it's of this demon, you know, and he's always clutching this scroll, and I think that just leads people to this idea that Buddhism is incredibly depressing, you know, we're all suffering,
and then
the whole world is in the clutches of this demon, right? Yeah. And his fangs are sort of hanging over the edge of the map, and it's this wheel, right? And the wheel shows, you know, an outer spoke or one of the spokes is sort of death and, you know, birth, old age, sickness, death, rebirth, you know, it's all painful. Mm. And then some of the inner spokes are the six realms. And so, you know, you have up to the jealous gods or warring gods, those are the asuras, I believe, and then you have the devas, which are the actual god gods, and then you have the humans, and then you have animals, you have pretas, which are kind of a mythical thing from Indian mythology. They have huge bellies and little tiny necks, and they're constantly starving, but they can only eat like one grain at a time.
Okay.
So it's this kind of poverty kind of mentality. And then you have hell beings, you know, that are right at the very bottom where they're just being burned alive or flayed or whatever, you know, all day or day. And as you know, as a Christian priest, that humans love these images of people being impaled, pitchforks, you know, iron plows, like plowing.
They love it.
They cannot get enough, right? Flames. And so that stuff, you know, is, of course, front and center in a lot of Tibetan mythology.
Okay, so you just said, so in that whole kind of realms, and so this is kind of Tibetan.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you know, it is extruded or sort of projected through the Tibetan lens, obviously, but it's those world systems are Buddhism.
Okay,
you know?
Gotcha.
And that was the big struggle, I think, that my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, well, that was what he struggled with. That was his main project, in some sense, was to, as much as he could, extricate the cultural piece from the Buddhist piece. And that's why he taught us more of the Sanskrit terms. He didn't dwell too much on the Tibetan terms.
Okay.
The Tibetans in general are very self-deprecating about their position. You know, they view that Oh, I just, in some sense, in the same way we are about Christ, right? Toward Jews, that Jews, Christ was himself a Jew. He spoke mm-hmm. Hebrew or Aramaic, you know, in the day-to-day. The Holy Land is over there somewhere, and, you know, we got the good news, and we're fortunate, you know, and the Tibetans have a similar kind of view. You know, I don't want to collapse this too much or oversimplify, but the Tibetans have this view that India is the holy, sort of the Holy Land, okay. That, you know, that's where the teachings originated. The Buddha was from India. Oh. So they're quite deprecating about, you know, India in some sense, but then at the same time, they have their own Buddha who came from what is now Afghanistan. He is called Guru Rinpoche or Padmasambhava, which means Padma or Pema is, in Tibetan, it's Pema, is lotus, and Sambhava is like to be born from. So he was born from the lotus because the belief was that he had a miraculous birth, I think somewhere near this lake. I'm not really sure on all the details, but in any case, he was a sort of a shaman. Mm. You know, he manifested all sorts of miracles that would not be out of place in, you know, the New Testament if he were one of the, again, I don't want to collapse things too much, but similar accounts. But he was pacifying a group of very warlike people that, you know, okay. lots of banditry. And I don't think any Tibetan would push back on this. Yeah. You know, it's like lots of places in Tibet outside of Lhasa or some civilized, you know, they had these dzongs that are, dzong means like a fortress.
Okay.
You know, and so you had sort of these fortresses and settlements, but a lot of the land was, you know, kind of, there was a lot of banditry, and, you know, our lineage stories are filled with stories of people trying to get to India to get more teachings and being beset by bandits, but then they're able to manifest this kind of miraculous, you know, they would do certain gazes or make yantra or they're like a talisman or something, and then the bandits would flee in terror because the bandits would perceive them as these, you know, multi, you know, gods with dark skin and three eyes and blue, you know, in Tibet, it's usually blue, dark blue skin is wrathful and fangs and all of that, or whatever else. They might perceive them as tigers.
Yeah, something
or,
you know, really scary.
Always something scary is happening, you know, or when they do the gaze, you know, and then the brigands or the bandits run off. And so anyway, I've, again, totally lost the path.
No, what you were this is really great. So,
but,
I mean,
but back to the what I was saying about the six realms is that there's this sense of being born again in these different realms. But for Trungpa Rinpoche, one of the interesting things he did was to sort of modernize that. So, you know, he would say people like, I'm going to name names here, you know, like, what's his name, Jeff Bezos, and I don't know, Shakira, and I'm just naming random people, you know, to be a rock star or a celebrity or even now, you know, like a content creator, you kind of live in this world where time doesn't exist and you have sort of limitless resources, and I mean, you live in a god realm, right? And
wow.
So right across the fence from you, in certain parts of the world especially, you might have a multimillionaire, say you live in a developing country.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cases, the gap of poverty is even worse than in the United States, if you can imagine.
Hard to imagine, but
right, when you stand at the border of Columbia University and you look out at, you know, the neighborhood it's in, or at least that used to be the case. It may have been gentrified now, but so adjacent to you could be someone who is that hungry ghost, that you know, the preta who's trying to eat. They have this big belly, you know, but they can't eat, or warring gods, you know, where you have this, you see this in politics, right? Republicans and Democrats, and these people are incredibly powerful and they have all this wealth, and, you know, Putin and Zelensky, or, you know, all of this is kind of this realm of, you know, warring gods. And so you don't have to literally be a cow to be in the animal realm.
Right.
You know, you could be, well, really, in terms of mentioning content creation and content consumption, you know, it's a dopamine pump, right? So you're just sitting there like a monkey in a cage. Every time you punch the button, a treat rolls out, you know, and so pretty soon you know, you're essentially an animal in a cage that's just, you know, and we see all sorts of art like this, right? So anyway, I forgot where I was even going with that, but just to say, to kind of sprinkle in some ideas of Buddhism in there, impermanence yeah. is the big thing. And then this notion of different births, you know, and how those kind of color the way you view the world and your even your ability. One of the things that we talk about is how fortunate it is to have a human birth, mm. to be born in a time that a Buddha has come to the earth or come okay. to the world. That Buddha not only came but could teach. That those teachings still abide in the world mm. is already makes you an incredibly fortunate person.
Wow.
To be born a man, you know, and this is, you get into sexism here, yeah. but I mean, in all of the traditional systems, if you weren't a man, your possibilities were pretty circumscribed, right? Mm-hmm. What you could and couldn't do. To be born free, you know, not have to go to, you know, in that holds in the modern world, to not have to go be literally chained to a manual, to some sort of treadle sewing machine in some third world country and sew 8,000
yeah.
pairs of tennis shoes in this, you know, this month or week or whatever, or be beaten or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think it has a lot of
well, you mentioned bagels. Something, you know, you're talking about, you know, the kind of the fortunateness of being born in this moment and all that, but it really changes your perspective. So when you're thinking about living your life, I know this is like a broad question, it's like, how has Buddhism, how does it inform you and kind of as you look at current society, where are some things that you feel like as a Buddhist, you look at some things and you might say, I might see that different, because you gave the example of people on social media are using their mm-hmm. phone, and you gave a really stark example of like, it feels like a monkey in a cage.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah.
Are there any other things that help you have a different lens or maybe a critique of something going on?
I would say mindfulness and meditation, you know, even though it's something that I've, frankly, you know, I fall off the wagon and I don't do it as much as I should, and then yeah. I start back, right? But just having that experience of having sat with my mind for a month,
mm.
Give or take, you know, and there was, you know, I had various meditation experiences that, you know, and you're sort of discouraged from bragging about these or talking about them at all, right? But I think it might be helpful for people to understand that,
yes,
you know, it
yeah.
works, you know, it really does happen. If you sit and meditate long enough, you will have these meditation experiences. I think the Tibetan word is nyams, and, you will perceive your own mind directly, and you will actually, in some cases, I won't say that I got all the way down to the core of the artichoke, right? The core of the artichoke is nothing, right? Mm-hmm. There is no core. That's very complicated to unpack, right? Our misunderstanding in the West of what nothingness is.
Okay.
But that's another discussion. Yeah. But directly perceiving, you know, working your way sort of down through the layers. And I actually almost had the experience of like the steam that mm-hmm. was coming off the water, whatever the water in the pot is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like we're concerned with all the vegetables that are up there steaming in the bamboo thing or whatever that in back, you know, in the 70s, you would buy it for $19.95 from Bronco and it was had all these, you know, stacks or whatever. But we're concerned with all of that, right? And we don't really get down to this, the water in the pot and the fire and what's really happening. But so the Buddhists have a view of what are called the skandhas, the heaps. And, you know, there are things like feeling formation, consciousness, you know, like deep down philosophical ideas about knowing and awareness, right? Mm. And are really heavy. And you can directly perceive those. If you practice meditation enough, you know, I never start there with people when I'm teaching meditation to people. I try to start with don't try to do more than 5 minutes.
Okay, so start with five.
Don't try to clear your mind.
Okay.
You know, it's trying to pin cows. If you've ever kept cattle, right? Like, I haven't, but from what, you know, what I've observed, cows are ornery. You know, and the more you try to constrain them, they will wallow. You know, they're not pretty. They're pretty strong, but not, you know, not in the ways you think of, right? Mm-hmm. But they will wallow. They will trample. They will just through perseverance, they will trample down your fence, and they will go wherever the heck they want to. You know, I mean,
right.
To a certain degree. Now you obviously stop that with some pretty severe intervention, but you know, that's what your mind does. You know, the more you try to. The more tightly you try to pin it, the worse it is, right?
Mm.
And so I try to teach the view of like the glass of water, right? You go out to the rushing stream and you take the glass of water and it's very silty and you can't see through it at all. But if you set it on the table and you just wait, it will settle out and then you can see through, you can see the luminosity. Mm. And so that's from a Buddhist perspective, I'd say that's the closest way I can explain what a soul, you know, Buddhists are anatma. Atman is like Mahatma Gandhi, mm-hmm. right? Great soul. So Buddhism is technically an anatma religion. You know, they don't believe in a soul, at least okay. not in an eternal sense.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, Buddhists would say there is no fundamental Dachshundness about Dachshund. You know, oops, I touched the mic. But in, if you were to strip me of having been born in Clay City, having been born a male, yeah. you know, various things, then I'm not Dachshund anymore, right?
Okay.
And by the same token, you know, then there are all these interesting questions like, well, how does reincarnation work? Yeah. And what's being reincarnated? From their perspective, it's mind. You know, it's okay. like the rock cycle. Like, you know, like if you can imagine the rock cycle as like a big washing machine, and I take the Washington Monument and I throw it in the millions years long wash cycle that is the rock cycle. At the end of that, I'm going to get particles of rock that are no longer...
Yeah.
I mean, are they the Washington Monument? Well, maybe on some philosophical level, but not really, right? They're just white limestone or whatever the thing yeah. is made out yeah. of. And at a certain level, they're not even going to be that anymore, right? Mm-hmm. They may be volcanic rock at some point, depending yeah. on how long we cycle the machine, right? Or the cosmic rock cycle mm-hmm. machine, if that makes any sense. So from that perspective, you have some sort of mind essence that might be the same,
okay.
but it isn't a soul in any kind of sense that I think Christians would buy or recognize. So it's probably one of the fundamental disconnects. Yeah. And of course, Buddhism is not an atheistic religion, it's a non-theistic religion, at least according to my teacher. And he was very, very fond of... what's his name? It's escaping me now. The monk at Gethsemane in Kentucky.
Oh, Thomas Merton.
Thank you, Thomas Merton. Yeah. You know, everybody likes to try to claim Thomas Merton.
Yeah, of
you
course,
know,
yes.
Well, he died in India, but he was on his way to become a Zen master in yeah. Japan. And no, you know, he was going to be whatever, yeah, right? Yeah. He's going to be a Jehovah's Witness, you know, whatever. No, he was going to be a Mormon, you know. I mean, everybody wants a piece of Thomas Merton, bless him, you know. It's like the man, you know, it was like a total... I mean, I think he electrocuted himself with a fan or something.
Yeah,
you know,
it was
a total sort of cosmic joke, right? I mean, it's not a very funny joke.
Yeah, but I hear you saying, yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know, it, on some level, it's like here was this man, it was this incredible right thinker, an incredible writer, and he was right here in Kentucky, and then he electrocutes himself, you know, in some, I guess, in India, you know. It is so in the same breath, it's a great tragedy. Right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
But Merton was, according to Trungpa Rinpoche, Merton was very, very close to non-theism.
Yeah.
You know, he was right at the gate. And, you know, non-theism doesn't mean that you don't believe in a higher power. It's just the way you define it,
yeah.
you know. Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, it depends on whether you think God is a one or a zero. And that took yeah. me quite a long time to unpack
That's
that one. But
is God know. A one or a zero?
Well, yeah.
You know, so can I go backwards
please,
a little bit?
Please, please.
You said, and you're talking about your own personal narrative, you know, these deaths are very important. Just loved ones and kind of sent you on a quest and or just a journey, right?
All right.
And what was it about the philosophy? And granted, this is the ocean you're swimming in. It just
right,
like,
right.
you know, you can go on for lifetimes knowing about it. But what was it that really? And I know you said you can't probably perfectly pinpoint that, but you are submerged in Clay City by Christians and all this kind of thing. And mm-hmm. and what was it about maybe thinking towards the East that really helped you?
I mean, if I'm being 100% honest
yeah.
with you, honestly, I think it was past life
okay, yeah, okay.
activity.
Yeah.
You know, like when I was very young, I was just drawn to everything Asian and Asia. And, you know, I lived at a time when, you know, you couldn't go and even eat Chinese food. Like
okay.
that was, you know, if you wanted to eat Chinese food, it was like a sit-down meal, very expensive. No way in heck my father was going to pay for that, you know. And he was like, you know, that stuff's not going to stick to your ribs. I want something I can't cook at home, you know. And the exoticism did not impress him one darn bit, right? Like, he had lived in Korea, and he was like, okay. You know, he'd been in the military, and he was like, no. And so they finally did take me to eat at this little Chinese eatery on the outskirts of Lexington. But, you know, I was probably like eight, maybe nine years old, and had been begging since, you know, whenever.
Interesting.
Yeah. And of course, my parents, I mean, I don't want to villainize them here. I was spoiled out of my mind as a kid. I got anything I pretty much asked for. But that was one thing Dad was like, no. And I guess I've grown up to be hangry like him. So I guess that was it. It's like, the only thing I won't give you, son, is something that's going to make me hangry. But in any case, you know, I can remember being a kid and watching the Shogun series on TV. I was in the second grade, I think, maybe late in the second grade, so I was 7 or 8 years old when that came on television. And of course, it's very fraught looking back on it now. But you know, it's not terrible. I read about it, and it's like, it's not as bad as probably it could have been. But again, you know, the remake is much better, I think, and less fraught. And I say this as somebody who lived, you know, in Japan and I worked, you know, in Japanese business for many, you know, 4 or 5 years. But in any case, I always had that interest. And then, you know, I went to study in China in 1994, went to Japan in 1998. And so it's just always kind of been an interest of mine. So I think I think it's just some affinity I have, you know, and whether you believe in past and future lives or not, you know, I think we all have kind of these just inborn affinities and even the Hinduism thing in India and, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time in India, but I've always just been fascinated by India. So I would say that. I don't know how else you know, I was always interested in samurai and ninja and all that. Yeah. And that sounds like on the face of it, like, okay, yeah, sure. You know, everybody loves Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? But when I was a kid, people didn't even know what the word ninja meant. They had no idea. And they knew what samurai were and samurai swords, but it was so incredibly exotic, Rob, that I can't convey to you, you know, in Appalachia or the, you know, kind of central Kentucky, Appalachia, you know, in the mid-70s, you know, to imagine as a kid that I might have a toy samurai sword would just the wildest thing in the world, right? Like, it just was unimaginable to me. And to the idea that there would actually be toys that you could go in and buy that were ninja toys, you know, just it would have blown my head off my shoulders, you know, at age 7 or 8, right? Yeah. So anyway, just always
had this affinity. I mean, growing up for no explained reason outside of had to be a past life.
Right,
I mean, this
right.
Affinity to Asia. So you just keep, you're pouring in, right? It ends up in China and Japan and you're in Nepal there. And as you've now, and like you said, you've shifted towards, or not shifted, but part of your career path has been, now you're doing therapy and you got your MSW and you're working on all that kind of stuff. And it seems like in some ways you're trying to embody this compassion for people. How does Buddhism kind of inform how you do therapy or how you see your clients or anything like that?
Well, I think that's it. You know, the other big thing, impermanence and then compassion. You know, those are kind of the two linchpins. Compassion in the face of impermanence. You know, one time some reporters came and the Karmapa, he's the head of, he's sort of like if you imagine the Dalai Lama, but the other lineage, the main practice lineage, they're called the stupid meditators. That's how they kind of jokingly are referred to in Tibet. You know, like the Sakyas are viewed as these great, the great theologians, for lack of a better term, you know, the great scholars and scholastics. The Gelugpas are like the ultimate monks. The Gelugs are the Dalai Lama's lineage. And then you have the Kagyus, and they're called the dumb meditators. Mm-hmm. And then the Nyingmas are sort of like the old wizards, you know, like they do most of the divination and the banishing demons and all of that kind of thing. And I mean, these are very, of course, I'm saying this very loosely, tongue-in-cheek kind of, but if you imagine, just to give people that don't know anything about it, there are four major lineages of Tibetan Buddhism, and they're viewed as mutually orthodox.
Okay.
There was a non-sectarian movement in the 18th century, I believe it was, called the Rime. Mei means without, and Ri would be a specific sectarian doctrine. So it's sort of like the non-denominational movement, you know, in Christianity. Similar thing happened in Buddhism, and it was like all of these lineages enrich our experience, and so we're, you know, they're mutually accepted. Same thing actually in Islam. You know, there are whatever the major, you know, branches are, and I don't know those, they're viewed as mutually orthodox. You know, that doesn't stop them. Again, they're humans. It doesn't stop either of these groups from trying to kill one another, right? and that's happened too. And you know, people have this view of Buddhism as all chill and all that. And we're like, there were monasteries openly at war with each other, killing each other. Like, that happened. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
People don't know that, and it's not something they advertise. Right? Come to the bet, you know, or whatever. It wasn't good for publicity, right? But it happened. So, anyway, where was I going with all this? You were asking about how
that informs any way you see your
so,
clients.
But so compassion is the other. Yeah. So the Karmapa, was interviewed by these reporters, and they said, "What is Buddhism in a word? Give us, you know, if you had to sum it up in one word." He said, "Oh, that's easy. Impermanence." And they were like, "Impermanence? You know, what is that?" And he said, through a translator, he says, "It means we'll all die one day. You know, or we'll all be dead one day." And they all just erupted into laughter, right? You know, because it's true, right? And so then in the face of that, compassion, right? Like, wisdom and compassion, and those are viewed in the Tibetan tradition. You see them a lot of times on tonka paintings, the scroll paintings that are sort of particular to Tibet and the Himalayan countries. I should start including Nepal in here. My Nepali friends would be mad at me, but you know, Nepal, you know, these places didn't have borders, right? There's all this argument about the Buddha was born in India. No, the Buddha was born in Nepal, you know, and all of that. Well, neither India nor Nepal existed then, right? I mean, these were kingdoms and whatever, but technically it is in Nepal, for the record. But the point is, you have these scroll paintings, and there's a sun and a moon, and those represent wisdom and compassion. So those are viewed as going together, you know.
Okay.
And you have wisdom, you have compassion, and that is the basis of Buddhism, is being kind to others, you know. And in the West, mindfulness and all of this is sort of touted, meditating, right? But to what aim? If you get up and you're, pardon my language, hold to the person, to everybody around you.
Sure.
You can sit for 3 years, but you come out of retreat and you're still a jerk.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point, right? So, you know, the hope is that by having these meditative experiences, like I said, it's not just, oh, wow, that's a trip. I actually got down to beneath even my emotions to some sort of, you know, preternatural or primordial something under there, that my lizard brain, right, or whatever. Okay, well, that's cool, but did that make you a more kind person?
Mm.
But I think what begins to happen is, on a more sort of a less, you know, I guess that would be the really sort of deep level, but on a grosser level, but a sort of more practical and useful level, is I start to see through my trips, is what we used to call them back in the old counterculture days, right? Yeah. And I was a sort of a late blooming hippie, right? You know, so I was way too young to be a hippie, but I, you know, so I picked up a lot of that lingo and read a lot of that stuff. But your trip, and I mean, we still use that term when you're on some kind of trip, you know, or you're tripping, you know, I mean, we start to see through our trips, you know, and we start to see that reality is a lot to do with how we see the world, you know, and that, as postmodernism and the project, if you could say post, you know, it's kind of interesting. People want to say, well, the gays are trying to do this, or the blacks are trying to do this, and it's always some other group is trying to hedge in on me and make me do. It's like, nobody has to do jack to you, buddy. You know, everybody I know is carrying around one of these, you know, and that's the project, right? That's the postmodern project. It has nothing to do with any kind of agenda on the basis of anybody except the people who are trying to get us to buy stuff, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I don't see anything in this phone that countermands my view of the world, right? Mm. It's all being tailored, and that's postmodernism, really. Or that's the sort of the apocalyptic, you know, end yes. game of postmodernism, is that everything is portable and, you know, modular, and we can unplug it here and stick it in there and it works. And all of that sounds great on the surface, but we end up in this sort of philosophical, like I said, end game where we feel put upon by everything, you know, and you know, I don't know, I guess I'm having an internal argument with myself in the middle of an interview, which is terrible, but you know, this sort of notion that we kind of hoped that the postmodern project would somehow make things more modern and
yes.
workable and yeah. all of this, right? And all it's done is really disconnect us from each other.
Well, I think that's the fascinating thing, you know, if in postmodernism we are having these critiques of, you know, certain, like, this is the only way you can see it, and now we have all the subtlety and context, and like, is there even an inherent reality or value,
right?
But then we get to the place where we keep pushing it out,
right.
and it's like, I want nothing but what I think.
Right,
where
right.
it's like, ah!
Right. You end up in this, you know, and that's the whole argument over wokeism, like, right? If you're a young black man, wokeism may sound awesome, right? But, you know, when you're an older white man, then it challenges all these things
yes.
that you deeply believed. And also, you're getting it presented to you as like the most radical, of course, version of wokeism.
Yes.
It's not like, hey, can everybody get along and have health care and basic...
Yeah.
No. You know, it's presented to you as, you know, people are falling down and, you know, bowing and apologizing to black people, which is something I can't imagine that black people would want, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
that would embarrass me and be really weird. I don't know, you know. And also this view that one person speaks for the crowd, you know,
right.
like we're all with, and I mean, that's the whole point of this podcast, right, or this
yeah.
video, is that within any group, there's all these different people that want different things, you know. And so I think that in of itself is a racist characterization of how blacks should work,
sure,
right,
yeah.
is that one person, one black person speaks for all black people and what that person, you know, trumps. But then we see it through the lens, the white lens of,
mm-hmm.
or the lens of white guilt.
Yeah,
you know,
right, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so it becomes incredibly nuanced. And that's a video from a different time, sorry. But back to compassion, you know, you just hope that meditating, you start to see through the solidity of whatever your particular viewpoint is.
Well, you know, let's come back to, you know, you talk about, I love how you say the compassion in the face of impermanence. You know, on the surface, when people start learning about impermanence, it can be super scary because you're challenging the idea that really nothing is permanent
yep.
and even your relationships, yourself, or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know?
Right, right.
But tell me a little bit about maybe, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but somewhat of freedom that can come with understanding permanence.
Yeah,
I mean, if that resonates.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I spend a lot of my time, actually. Well, not a lot of my time, but I teach meditation to a lot of my clients.
Okay,
and
use it very heavily in your...
Yeah, I use it, and to the degree to which a person can even meditate. And
sure.
I think that's another thing that we have to remember, is that some people, you know, when they have an attention deficit disorder... I think they can still meditate. They just need psychoeducation about what meditation is. You know, a lot of people
okay.
say, well, I just can't clear my mind. You know, it's like, well, that's not the point. The point is just sort of watch it, right? Like,
okay.
And if your mind is like a, you know, Costco distribution center and you're sitting up here on a little parapet looking at the whole thing run, that's okay. That's still meditating, right? My mind might be like a field and, you know, at 3 a.m. up here, you know, at the head of some creek or, you know, John's Creek, Island Creek, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's crickets and it's lightning bugs, but it's pretty boring, you know, or maybe I think it's glorious, right? I mean, so it doesn't really matter how active your mind is in that, it's that you're watching and that you continue to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I talk a lot about shamatha, vipassana meditation. So shamatha is abiding, essentially. It's putting your mind on a point. You know, there's sort of 3 reference points. You use the posture, the breath, and your gaze to connect with a spot in your mind, essentially.
Okay.
And it's kind of represented by, say, a spot on that wall over there, you know, between the cinder blocks or whatever, right? And I picked that point. But the idea is that you just keep putting your mind on that point. And
okay.
it will fall off as mine frequently has throughout this interview, but then you put it back.
Yeah, you just keep coming
and
back.
And you just keep coming back. And then as your shamatha practice stabilizes, theoretically, if you do it consistently, and doing it consistently is more important than doing it for duration.
That's just a helpful understanding. It's really not about me. I need to start by sitting for 4 hours.
No.
It's really just consistently every day.
It's just like lifting weights, you know, and I mean, I don't know diddly do.
But
from what I understand, right, it's intensity, you know, there's a little acronym, mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, you don't go to the gym your first time and try to lift 300 pounds for 2 hours. You never get anywhere, right?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of the same idea, is that you start with just 5 minutes. You can't talk yourself out of that, most importantly in the modern mm-hmm. world, and then you just put your mind back in this spot.
Okay.
And I think it's important not to have a reference in the sense of any kind of thing going on behind, you know, some people want to play a guided those things are fine if you're trying to just relax.
Okay.
But if you want to really do meditation, I mean per se meditation, I would, and those are meditations too, so I shouldn't say per se. Mindfulness meditation, if you want to cultivate mindfulness, use mindfulness training, which is some sort of shamatha vipassana-based thing, right?
Yeah, okay.
And then the vipassana is sort of this panoramic awareness that develops out of the stability of the shamatha, of having this kind of ability to, and you get better at it. You know, your mind, you know, and I used to see this when I was a very young man with my practice. Like, it started out, you know, it would take me like 25 or 30 minutes just for my mind to settle out. But then as I did it day in, day out, I started noticing at about the 25-minute mark for me, I would rest, I would settle out. And then I would sit another 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and I had to get up and stretch my legs, right? But I had those 5 or 10 minutes of really kind of doing it, you know, and that's why we call it practicing meditation. My teacher always made the distinction. He said, your meditation practice, you know, he stressed that, like, you're not meditating, you're practicing meditation. Because, you know, you may sit for 5 minutes and have one moment of clarity.
Yes.
That's okay. That one moment of clarity from a traditional Buddhist perspective undoes aeons of negativity and ignorance and whatever, or could, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So just to say a little bit about that, the practice, and then in my therapy, when I think a person's open to it, then I try to introduce that. And journaling and other things that you can kind of do in a kind of a mindfulness point of view. But to kind of go back to your broader question about how it informs your world, I think, as you sit and you watch your mind speed, you know, and then you watch your mind again another day and it's not as speedy, then you start to realize, I'm not necessarily who I thought I was. I change, you know.
Mm.
And of course, we all know these things on a kind of axiomatic level. Well, people change, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but then it's like, to actually see it with your own eyes and perceive it directly, then you realize, oh, maybe I'm not the same from day. I'm also not the same guy who, you know, relapsed on meth and did this, and this, or, you know, stole something off one of my relatives to pay for my habit, or robbed a bank, or whatever you did, right? Or I'm not the dude that, you know, I mean, all of the evil in the world, right? In some sense, yes, you're that same person, and of course, society is going to hold you to account.
Of course, yeah.
But then in another way, you're not that person anymore. You're not that same person. You know, and you can go very deeply, obviously, with the compassion. One of the great people to read is Shantideva.
Okay.
If you can read Shantideva. And I think maybe you even have a Shantideva quote around campus here. Maybe. I seem to think that I saw a Shantideva quote. But from the Bodhicharya Avatara, that's a tough one. But so Bodhi comes from the same root, Bud, which means Buddha, or Buddha to awaken, right? Mm-hmm. And then the Bodhicharya Avatara is something translated, you could translate it sort of as alighting on the path of awakenment.
Mm.
It's kind of the way, you know, Avatara, I mean, you know, is like avatar, you know, like your avatar in a computer game.
Yeah.
You know, you're embodying this bodhicharya, you know, this progression toward awakenment or toward enlightenment in more kind of general terms. But he goes very deeply about, you know, forgiving your enemies, you know, like, and, and so I do a lot of that with my patients, trying to kind of, sometimes I, if they're open to it, I try to do thought experiments, you know, sort of like, what would Rob Music now think of, you know, maybe you're having some guilt about something you did when you were 16.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, would, what would Rob Music say to 16-year-old Rob Music, you know, or if this was one of your students that came in and they had done this to this person, or they had done, made this mistake, would you hold them to the same, you know? And it's just amazing how people can, it's really easy to, at least in this society, it's in culture, it's the West generally, it's easy to forgive others, but it's very difficult to forgive ourselves. And that's another disconnect in Buddhism, is that, like, Asian people, generally speaking, you know, they have a completely different experience because of the global inequality, you know, and industrialization and nuclearization of families. And we've ended up in these really fractured, fraught family situations. That, not to say they don't exist in developing countries, but not at the rate, or at least they didn't. At the rate. They had other issues. They had other problems. That's not to say that people don't get drunk and beat their kids or their wife or whatever. I saw it in Nepal sometimes, you know, and those things happen just like in every other place in the world. But it's really tough for Asians to look, you know, they can't understand why Westerners hate themselves. You know, and that's one of the things
really
when you talk to lamas who are sort of traditional Tibetan lamas, they didn't, you know, when they're presenting these talks and they're kind of from the standpoint of, oh, well, of course, it's easy to forgive yourself, but you can't forgive others, right? And they're like, no, in the West, it's the other way around, right? Like, I can forgive other people relatively easily, but anyway, in any case, sorry again.
Well, no, that's really, I mean, helpful in the way that particularly, like, you're trying to introduce it to clients or patients and trying to help them. And really what I hear you saying is you're even meeting them with compassion on what they're capable of, longing for, and and as you're diving into your own kind of continued practice. I guess one of the other questions I have is, as you've been on this journey, because you're not, it's different when you're in Nepal, right? But when you're in Clay City or you're in Pikeville or whatever, you're not perpetually surrounded by a bunch of people who are also Buddhist or practitioners.
Right.
And at any point, have you ever faced any kind of, like, kind of aggressive questioning, pushing, anything like that because of your practice or any kind of opposition?
Well, certainly. I mean, my mother, my grandmother, I think, thought that I had joined a cult, you know, and I mean, I guess in fairness to them, I, in some sense, I had, you know, I mean, it wasn't, I didn't have any money for them to take, or, you know, I wasn't being exploited, you know, my labor wasn't or whatever, but I guess in some sense it was a cult, and fair play, you know, but then, you know, as I aged and I didn't unconvert, you know, from Buddhism, then people, I think, started to have a little more respect. And also, I was less pushy. You know, I think probably, I hate to say that, to make this, again, I was like, I'd love to tie all this up in this crystal moment, but I think I can here. You know, it really was about my own aggression. You know, my aggression against the way Christianity, and my resentment about the way Christianity had been presented to me. And once I went to college and I realized it was sort of a flip-flop for me, right? Like, I realized, like, oh, Christianity is not all bad. You know, like, we can practice Christianity, you know, the true, you know, when I actually became saved and baptized, you know, as a Christian.
Oh.
But I was sort of in this kind of la-la land, you know. And then when the la-la kind of ran out, then I was like, well, this is bunk, you know. And then I became very resentful toward it, you know, sort of.
Okay.
But it wasn't super resentful. It wasn't like it was, you know, like I'm an angry young man with, you know, that kind of thing. It wasn't quite that, but... I guess I was suspicious of it.
Sure.
And then as I aged, I kind of came back around. And oddly, a lot of this was, you know, I grew up in the Satanic Panic, and I love Dungeons and Dragons, as you know. And a lot of this came from playing Dungeons and Dragons with Christians.
Okay.
You know, with ministers, with, what do you call it, deacons and elders and all of that, right? And so in the old days, it was the deacons and elders were trying to... you know, pillory us all for our satanic worship, yes, or warn us against it, you know, or our parents. And then, you know, we graduate to the point where we're just hanging out in the church basement and all of us are playing and the kids are playing. And, you know, so it was a lot of, it was kind of funny and ironic, but that's where I kind of really came to appreciate Christianity and appreciate, I started to feel compassion for people like you, like you, Rob, okay. You know, like here's a good guy that's just trying to serve and trying to be a light in the world and do good and be compassionate. And there are all these bungholes out there, you know, that are just screwing it up for him, you know, by all these bizarre assertions that have nothing to do, right? Like, yeah. And, you know, and I guess that's one thing about Buddhism that used to really, it's funny in one sense, it used to infuriate me.
Okay.
I went to, when I worked in Japan, you know, I went there for a year and taught, and there was this French girl, and she came to know that I was Buddhist, and I may have even said as much. And she's like, oh, you Americans, you're all Buddhists, you know? And I'm like, yes, me, all of us. You know,
like, Every one of us.
There are hundreds of thousands of us just, you know, like, you know, but it was like, because she had seen, you know, like five American celebrities and, you know, had converted to Buddhism or practiced Buddhism, you know, and I'm just like, how short-sighted, you know, I wanted to, you know, smack her, of course, you know, but they're saying, oh, that wouldn't be very Buddhist of me to smack the taste right out of her mouth, right? But, you know, but it was just hilarious, like, to me, that to her, this was all, you know, she viewed all non-French people as like some sort of alien race that she was trying to figure out. Right? And anyway, so that was sort of the only real pushback I had, was this kind of stereotype that I was, you know, some kind of way, right? And then at home, it's interesting because it was a positive stereotype for the most part.
Yeah.
That like, okay, Buddhists are chill. You know, they don't say that you can't smoke weed or drink, or, you know, they seem to be, it's all hippies, so they don't want to say any of those things. You know, and they're, you know, sometimes they're kind of hard about being vegetarians, and not all the time. You know, it's like, it sounds like a really cool religion to me, you know, and I think I'll convert, right? And everybody should be compassionate and chill, and right. And so that's kind of, you know, if anything, that was the kind of the stereotype, you know. So it kind of puts you in a position, strangely, I felt I was able to minister to people, as bizarre as that might sound, that people weren't expecting me to come at them with some sort of Christian trip, and I didn't, because I wasn't a Christian.
Yeah.
But I could still come at them with some kind of a trip, in some sense of, you know, maybe you feel this way about your life because of this, and maybe if you tried this, that, you know, or try to be more compassionate, you know what I'm saying? And and so it creates a liminal space, you know. It's like the Venn diagram.
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of in the middle. I grew up a Christian, and I understood a lot about what Christians believed and the values they have, but I don't feel that I belong anymore, right? And so, and you know, and then I've actually come to the point almost now where I wonder, should I say I'm a Christian? You know, like, it doesn't matter to me. You know, it's like the Dalai Lama now, he's like, you know, the guy raises his hand and says, well, you know, I want to, you know, convert to Buddhism, and I'm interested in the, and the Dalai Lama's like, no, don't do that. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, just continue to be a good guy and just practice your own religion. You know, you're going to get further with people, I think was the point the Dalai Lama was trying to make. It's not really about, you know, and maybe some hardline lamas and, you know, or Tibetan lamas would have been appalled by that. I don't know. But that's one of the things that Trungpa Rinpoche tried to kind of preach against, was what he called playing cowboy and Indian. You know, like putting on, appropriating another culture, kind of putting on the, well, you know, the feathered bonnet or the cowboy hat or whatever, right? When you're not really, okay, you know, you own no cows and you're not a Native American. You have no, you know, like. And that's really fraught now, right, in terms of appropriating culture. I think people carry it too far, obviously. Yeah. You know, we all, every culture in the world has, you know, Momos are the most Tibetan thing in the world, right? They got that from the Chinese, right? Like, you know, and I mean, I'm sure there are a million Chinese things that they got from the Tibetans, right? Because the Manchus, you know, were a semi-nomadic group that conquered China, and they brought, you know, and the Mongols. I mean, imagine the amount of Mongol, the amount of culture that was disseminated just by Genghis and Kublai Khan and their conquests. You know, they were picking up, you know, glassware from Persia and depositing it over here in, I don't know what, where, you know, the one of the, you know, in the Central Asia somewhere, you know, in one, somewhere. Anyway, but that's something that he was suspicious of. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think he spent a lot of his time trying to extricate Buddhism from its kind of cultural moorings and present, like, this is what the Buddha taught. This is what I think the spirit of what the Buddha taught was, you know, and this is how, most importantly, this is how you apply it to your life as a modern person.
I say you'd almost have to have a kind of a, I don't want to say shocking, but a very different type of person to be able to bring that message, because it clearly is.
Oh,
like,
and he was, as I said, he you know, like I said, he one day you would see him, at least according to one of my old mentors, Bill Gordon. He was a professor at UK and became a Buddhist and studied with Trungpa Rinpoche, at least, you know, for a time before Trungpa Rinpoche passed away. And he said one day you would see him and he would be in the full, like, chuba, Tibetan, kind of, you know, sort of like a kimono, for lack of a better term, but, you know, a sort of Tibetan robe. And or he would be in a monk's robe, you know. Or the next day he might be in a Zen, full Zen thing with the, I forget what they call the apron, you know, that they have to sew. And, you know, all sewn exactly like it was supposed to be, and to the great, he was very good friends with one of the Zen masters, I think, Shunryu Suzuki, not the other older Suzuki, but I can't remember what his name was, maybe Daitetsu, anyway, I'm probably going to butcher that, but in any case, he was friends with that Zen master, and actually a lot of that Zen master's students, he wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When he passed away, a lot of his students joined Trungpa Rinpoche.
Ah.
And so, you know, we have an Orioki practice, which is a Japanese Orioki practice that we do in retreat. That's the way we take meals, you know, just as if we were a monastic place with a Japanese, you know, roshi for our head, you know. So there were a lot of things that we appropriated, going back to cultural appropriation, or that mixed together, because we were trying to make, or he was trying to make, an American Buddhism, you know, that was applicable to our lives. And that's one of the reasons he did these weekend intensive kind of things. You know, it was almost like a business. I don't know if you remember these old Dale Carnegie business things where you show up Friday night and you go through Sunday afternoon, then you go back to work on Monday morning. You know, he did these kind of weekend intensives where you would meditate all weekend. There was a format where you would do a public talk on Friday evening. If you wanted to stay for the weekend, you could. If you didn't, no, you know, it was no charge. And then there was a sort of like a weekend seminar where you would, Saturday and Sunday, you would sit, and it was interspersed with talks and things like that. And so and I found that as a young student at UK, that was imminently approachable and easy to do.
Wow.
You know, okay, I want to do a meditation weekend this weekend. And so, you know, I was never setting the world on fire as far as cracking the books at UK, but I'd get all my work done, you know, and then I had the weekend and I would meditate and then go back to class on Monday morning, you know. And so again, I'm off on a rail spur there, but hopefully that got somewhere in the ballpark.
So
as we
close, you know, as people are thinking about, you know, of course now it's a very different, you got the internet now, you can't even get to a Chinese restaurant, right?
Right, right.
But you kind of mentioned a couple things, you know, like Shante Deva and any kind of work there, starting with 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And trying
to
be present with your own mind.
Yeah.
Would you have any other insights for anybody that's...
I would say the main thing is just rest in the luminosity. Rest in your mind is primordially stainless. It's like a mirror, you know, in medieval times, mirrors had to be polished, you know, that's why they were so expensive. There was no easy way to create them, right? Or you had to pour glass and then put silver on the back of it later on. But generally in the beginning, they were just highly, highly polished metal surfaces, right?
Wow.
And so that's kind of how your mind is a mirror. And whatever obscurations or impediments you have to manifesting compassion for other people are just momentary. They're transitional. And so you just rest in your own goodness. Mm. And keep consistently polishing that mirror, and it will brighten, you know, and be more clear. That's, I guess, the work slowly. You know, don't get in too big of a hurry. I guess that's probably the biggest thing I would say for people.
Sure. And it's going to take more than one lifetime, right? So it's like, there's no don't be in a hurry, right?
Right, right. I mean, theoretically, you can get enlightened in one lifetime, but, you know, that's the supermasters. You know, when I was a young man, I thought, yes, I'm definitely going to be, you know, I mean, like all young men, I was full of piss and vinegar, and I was like, yes, I want to be enlightened in one lifetime. But as you age, you know, that changes in you. And then the project really isn't to get enlightened, right? Ultimately, that's, I guess, something I left out of all of this, is that the project is compassion. That is the ultimate level. You know, you don't get enlightened so you can just bliss out and escape, right?
Yeah.
Like, Westerners used to misunderstand this notion of samsara, which it meant in some sense extinguishment, right? Mm-hmm. Or to be extinguished. And so Westerners just thought you just go into nothingness, and that's the ultimate aim, is just to, you know, discorporate into some sort of nihilistic end, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not it. You become enlightened and you still chop wood and carry water, like the old thing.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do before enlightenment? What do you do after enlightenment? Chop wood, carry water, right? But hopefully that informs your behavior towards others, and that's an ongoing thing for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, one minute you want to strangle your, you know, husband, wife, kid, whoever, right? And the next minute you it's my baby and I love him or her so much, and you know, I can't live with it. And I mean, that's our experience in a nutshell, right? So but the ultimate aim is to be a bodhisattva. That's the mm-hmm. bodhicharya avatara. That's the end goal, is to be this awakened heart. I guess a bodhicitta is awakened heart, right? And so to manifest that, it's not to in full enlightenment, it's manifesting an awakened heart for other people.
Yeah.
So that you can kind of get out of your own way and be helpful to other people.
Like a deeper compassion, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's
absolutely.
Essentially what that's exactly what it is. Is just how far can you push your compassion, you know?
And yeah.
That starts to be indistinguishable from your awareness, your sense of self, or, you know, like, I guess sense of self in some sense, it's inversely to whatever degree you have a sense of self, right? You start to have a sense of oneness, and the more oneness you can have, the, you know. But I wanted to go back, you know, about practicing therapy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think it was Carl Rogers talked about unconditional positive regard.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's just because Carl Rogers said it, and he's he was an MD, I think he was a psychiatrist, I'm not sure, but because this dude with a lot of schooling said it, and he said it in this obtuse way, now it's cool. It's part of, you know, it's part of Western biomedicine, right? And so I can write that all day long in my notes, unconditional positive regard.
That's amazing, you know, because he said it.
Yeah, if I were a llama and I came in here in robes with my head shaved and I was like, just be compassionate to these people and treat them like human beings, they'd be like, well, that's great. That's great advice, Dax. And thank you for coming in. We'll
dismiss that.
Don't let the doorknob hit you where the good Lord splits you, you know, as you go out. And that'd be the end of it, right? But so in some sense, you know, Carl Rogers is like this bodhisattva. You know, it's like he manifested in this... that's how I think of him, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, he seemed to be an incredibly lovely and compassionate person. But, you know, he manifests in this very uptight U.S. in the early 60s, whatever. I mean, obviously he was born before that, but that's kind of when he comes on the scene and he makes this statement, and it revolutionizes everybody's kind of view of what is the project? What are we doing here, you know?
Wow.
And it's like unconditional positive regard.
Yeah.
So... I think I'll end on that, you know, if I may. That's the project, unconditional positive regard. Do it as fully as you can in whatever way you understand it. And just understand the golden rule of do unto others only works in your culture. You know, do unto others as they would have you do unto them. You know, like sometimes we think we're helping and, you know, the view of helping someone in India or Malaysia or Singapore may it be a completely different thing than what. And I think that's where, particularly in this modern world where we have so much more diversity than we used to. Well, we actually probably always had the diversity, right? I mean, and that's the point of this whole thing, right? This whole series is, you know, think of all the black people in Appalachia that never, you know, the Afro-Latchans that never get until Frank Walker, you know, comes along and sort of like, hey, look at this. People don't know, right? And how could they or how would they? Even if they're well-meaning or they want to know those things, they maybe they don't have access. So I would say just remember that. Remember the golden rule needs to be a little modified for the modern world. And then how do I do that? Unconditional positive regard and openness, you know, just just ask people, what do you need from me? You know, that's one of the things my old mentor used to say, how can I help you? You know, and he got that actually from one of his teachers, you know, that you don't have to necessarily even like the person, but if you can put on that, sometimes we're play acting, right? But through play acting, we actually come to realize like, this guy, I thought he was a jerk, but really he's in a really terrible situation. You know, then we, compassion is born in us, right? So anyway, I've talked enough.
This is great. I really appreciate your time and just what you're doing in the world. So thanks for being on here.
I'm happy to be here. I'm honored to be asked. Thank you. When I simply don't obey.